This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When you really look at the track record of the rest of the world in actually reducing emissions, it's no better than the U.S. And the argument that but for these crazy climate deniers in the U.S., we would be on track to do something meaningful about climate change, I think is just belied by the fact that all of these places that don't have a climate-denying conservative party have done no better than the U.S. in getting their emissions down.
Are the cries for a complete transition to renewable energy from environmentalists like Bill McKibben actually undermining the work to combat climate change? That's the position of our guest today on Sea Change Radio. Ted Nordhaus is the co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute, an Oakland-based think tank which focuses on energy issues. We discuss Nordhaus's recent piece in Foreign Policy magazine, assess the damage that climate change denialism in the U.S. has wrought on the planet, and examine the methods used by both pro-environment and anti-environment activists. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the co-founder and the executive director of the Breakthrough Institute, Ted Nordhaus. Ted, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Alex.
It's good to have you. We've had several of your colleagues over the years, like Jesse Jenkins and Alex Trembath, but I wanted to talk to you about a piece that you co-authored with Alex that was published in Foreign Policy called "The Polarization of the Climate Issue Continues." Why don't you first give a brief executive summary of the piece, if you can.
Well, the piece makes a couple of observations. The first is that the Paris Agreement and the Trump administration's decision to pull out of it, I mean, in some level, we're mostly dealing with sort of the politics of symbolism on all sides. So, you know, it's a non-binding agreement in which most of the nations practically made commitments in terms of sort of reducing emissions and deploying cleaner sources of energy that were probably things that they would have done anyway. And, you know, proponents of the accord made fairly sweeping claims about what a breakthrough it was, and opponents on both sides, those who felt it didn't do enough and those who felt that it did too much, made sort of sweeping claims as well. And really, when you look at sort of the rhetoric on all sides of the debate about Paris, it doesn't line up very well with sort of what the agreement actually did. Our view is that it was important, not necessarily for the reasons that a lot of people thought, which was that it basically got major emitting countries sort of talking to each other about what they were really actually prepared to do to reduce their emissions, as opposed to what we've seen for most of the last 25 years, which is sort of really negotiations over long-term temperature targets and emissions reduction commitments that, even when they were ostensibly binding, really had no impact whatsoever on what anyone actually did. So that was the sort of first key part of our argument. And the second then is that, you know, so when you really look at, well, why did the Trump administration pull out of this non-binding agreement? It really sort of speaks to the ways in which the climate debate has gotten just impossibly polarized over the last decade, particularly. And, you know, there are a bunch of folks on the right side of the political spectrum, fossil fuel interests, libertarian and other sort of ideological opponents of these sorts of agreements who have very intentionally worked to polarize the debate. But we also point out that particularly after the failure of cap and trade legislation in the U.S., climate advocates in many cases decided to take actions that in to some degree were intentionally intended to further polarize the debate. And, you know, our argument is that polarization of the debate serves opponents of climate action. It really, really does not serve those who want to see action. And so while you can understand the frustration, the decision to sort of polarize the debate, to make fossil fuel development and use of all kinds a litmus test for Democratic politicians, has not served the interest of those of us who actually would like to see the U.S. And the world make progress on climate change. It makes it harder, not easier.
And you're kind of saying that the right, by not looking at real solutions for the climate, is doing its own party a disservice in that a lot of the things that it advocates could be put into that climate solution basket, such as nuclear and natural gas. But you're also saying that the left is maybe not being as pragmatic as it should be.
I think there's just been a lot of, for lack of a better word, sort of mischief on how the climate issue has been handled on the left for a very long time.
Yeah, let me quote what you wrote in the beginning of your piece in Foreign Policy, and I think that's a good leaping off point for what I think you're about to discuss. You say, for example, Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, who's been on Sea Change Radio several times, could only offer faint praise for the accord in a December 2015 New York Times op-ed, charging that it did just enough to, quote, keep both environmentalists and the fossil fuel industry from complaining too much. McKibben changed his tune this past week, claiming that the U.S. withdrawal from the accord, quote, undercuts our civilization's chances of surviving global warming. You say that the response from people like Bill McKibben is contradictory, and I don't see it that way personally, but why don't you explain where you see this contradiction?
Well, I mean, basically, you know, the message from McKibben, you know, I mean, it's more like damning with faint praise when you really get down to it, which is basically this is, you know, what he really said in his New York Times piece back, you know, a couple of years ago when the Paris deal got done was this is just business as usual. And it's a disaster. He basically called President Obama and Hillary Clinton climate deniers. So when it's a Democratic president, you claim this is sort of a sellout that, you know, makes no difference whatsoever for what's going to happen with the climate. And then when Trump pulls out, you say that, you know, it's doing so has undermined the world's chances of addressing and avoiding catastrophic climate change. You really can't reconcile those two positions, in my view.
I think damning with faint praise is maybe a better characterization than saying that they're contradictory, because I don't see McKibben's stance as being contradictory. I see it like, let's say somebody says that peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are not a healthy lunch, but just because you don't want to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch doesn't mean you don't want to eat lunch. He's looking at solutions and he's looking at Paris as falling short, but he doesn't want the U.S. to be a rogue nation. And that's what just occurred. And so he looks at that as much worse than the damning with faint praise of the initial Paris agreement. I don't think that's necessarily contradictory.
I guess you could very generously make that point. But, you know, I do think that on the one hand, you say this is just, you know, 2 years ago, you say this is all just theater to pretend like we're doing something. And then, you know, when the Trump administration says, you're right, it's just theater, and we're not going, you know, we're going to pull out of this thing, you say it's the, you know, it's the end of the world. And My larger concern here is not what Bill McKibben says about Paris now versus 2 years ago, but it's been the sort of determination to build, and this has been an explicit strategy. The idea was after the failure of cap and trade, that the environmental movement needed to go build an issue public in the Democratic Party that would basically sort of demand that Democratic politicians sort of toe the party line on climate in the same way that, they are expected to do so on healthcare or on abortion rights or any number of other issues.
And you don't like those litmus tests, right?
I think that kind of litmus test, I think litmus test politics, perhaps in particular contexts, can be effective. But for an issue like climate change, where you have to sustain consistent policy for decades across, Democratic and Republican administrations, Democratic and Republican Congress, control of the legislative branch, I think it's a terrible idea.
Watch out, girl, the words you say that don't really fit the play. You might talk to now knows what you say and what you mean. They don't help you stand. You might say you ain't got a hold on yourself. You might say you always try your best. You might say you only need a rest. You might
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm talking to Ted Nordhaus. He's the executive director and co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute. So, Ted, you also write, environmentalists from leading NGOs such as the NRDC to leading advocates such as McKibben have intentionally conflated climate science with their longstanding ideological preferences for regulations, taxes, and renewable energy. I assume you meant carbon taxes in that sense. Now, by the same token, wouldn't the Breakthrough Institute have their own standing ideological preferences for things like nuclear energy and natural gas? We're all looking for solutions, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're conflating climate science with those solutions, does it?
Well, no, just not to pick on McKibben, because there's lots of others who've done it, but, he just wrote in Rolling Stone a couple of months ago that if you don't believe we can power the entire world with wind, water, and solar, you're a climate denier.
That does seem like a crazy thing to say. And I I'm glad you put that in context. That seems like a reasonable explanation. It wasn't clear from reading that sentence, the conflation that you were referring to, but now I understand. You also, I don't know if it's in this piece or maybe it was on social media, but I remember you referenced how the way environmentalists made a lot of hay over the Keystone XL pipeline, which in bottom line terms won't be as big a game changer as depicted, how that became a real cornerstone of their struggle over the last several years. There's parallels to be made with Paris. So please summarize the analogy if you can.
So after the failure of the cap and trade effort in 2010, sort of the place that the environmental movement went was the Keystone battle. And the idea is we're going to draw a line in the sand. Again, we're going to make this a litmus test. And we're going to make sort of any kind of fossil development whatsoever a litmus test. And I think the fallout from that in doing so is they made it not only a litmus test on the left and for the Democratic Party, but on the right and for the Republican Party. So and the danger here and what we're already seeing is that not only did fossil development become a litmus test, support for fossil development become a litmus test, but support for clean energy is becoming a litmus test as well. So where historically, they weren't down with carbon regulations or carbon taxes, they weren't down with shutting down the fossil fuel industry, but there was a fair amount of support among Republicans for both for renewable energy, for nuclear, for a variety of clean energy technologies, and at least for making investments to develop those technologies. That has become a sort of collateral damage in the polarization of the climate debate. And I think at the end of the day, ultimately, our ability to develop cheap, scalable clean energy technologies is going to determine how far we get on reducing emissions. And that may do vastly more damage than anything that happens around things like Paris or the Clean Power Plan or any of the sort of traditional policy measures that that climate policy has centrally focused on.
I can't help but think that you're getting a little hung up on the litmus test element of it, instead of looking at where the extremes are on both sides of this debate. On one side, yes, you have a litmus test on the right where they're saying if you believe in climate change, then you're some loony tree hugger. And then on the left, you have, without using the rhetoric that McKibben had in terms of saying you're a climate change denier if you don't believe that renewables can power the whole world, at least on that side of things, they're looking at facts and reality in terms of climate change is real and looking for solutions. There are lots of different solutions. And I think one side is basically looking at reality and the other's head is in the sand. So by making these false equivalencies between, oh, we're both having these intractable discussions and litmus tests, yeah, both are doing it, but one is actually looking for solutions while they're attached to facts and reality. The other is just pretty much delusional. Is that unfair?
I mean, honestly, the idea that you're going to power the entire world with wind and solar is pretty delusional, too.
I don't think that's necessarily what most environmentalists think.
You would be hard-pressed to find any major environmental NGO whose position is anything other than that we need to power the entire world with wind, water, and solar.
Well, it's aspirational. It doesn't mean it's delusional.
Well, no, I mean, that's the position. That's their advocacy. We still can't even get these groups to come out and formally support keeping existing nuclear plants open.
And I understand the upsides and downsides of that, but I think you're maybe conflating aspirational with a litmus test.
Well, I think if there's any litmus test that has really defined modern environmentalism over the last 40 years, it's been that you're anti-nuclear.
Yes. And we had this debate with your colleague Jesse Jenkins when Fukushima happened. And I think that some of his predictions have come full circle. And we've seen a lot of the damage that Fukushima had, not just in terms of the nuclear fallout, but the fallout in terms of policy around the globe. Why don't you maybe expand on that?
Yeah, well, there was not very little actual fallout, but there was a big political fallout. You can make, I think, a reasonable case that at least given the existing nuclear technologies we have commercialized today, that, whatever the long-term costs, the upfront costs of building new nuclear plants, there's an economic justification for not doing so. But when you look at the closure of plants around the world in recent years, it's really the fallout of decades of anti-nuclear sort of ideology and propaganda and exaggeration of the risks and an unwillingness to recognize the benefits. So I don't want to get hung up on that. My larger point is that, You can, you know, sort of, this is sort of the idea that sort of climate science denial is sort of in a fundamentally different than, you know, an environmental movement that has really put the agenda on the table, has defined the agenda, and has basically taken sort of every solution that folks on the other side of the ideological spectrum might be able to embrace off the table quite actively. This isn't just sort of an oversight. So that's one point. But putting that aside, even if you said the right bears far more responsibility for the polarization of climate politics than the left, and I think I might even be able to be willing to grant that. Polarizing climate politics, if you are an opponent of action, is a rational and smart strategy. And our argument in this piece is that, by contrast, if you support climate mitigation, that polarization is a terrible strategy. So even if much of the energy to polarize that debate has come from the right, if you're on the left and you support action, why would you pour gasoline on that fire? It makes no sense.
Got guns in my name, give the right to plunder land. Though the chicken harvest can't even find lands with both their hands. Doctrines in motion, crusades in full swing. Got guns in my name.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm talking to Ted Nordhaus. He's the executive director and co-founder of the Breakthrough Institute. In the piece, you're drawing parallels between the right and the left in the U.S. But if we look at it from a global perspective, the left in the U.S. has many other movements that are analogous in other countries, right? You have big anti-nuclear movements in France and Switzerland or wherever, but the climate change denying movement in the right stands alone in the world. And that's the thing that really stands out to anybody who looks at this from afar. These are not equal, because the rest of the world looks at this and in shock and horror and laughs at us.
My response to that would be, yes, that's an excellent point you make. And when you really look at the track record of the rest of the world in actually reducing emissions, it's no better than the U.S. And the argument that but for these crazy climate deniers in the U.S., we would be on track to do something meaningful about climate change, I think is just belied by the fact that all of these places that don't have a climate-denying conservative party have done no better than the U.S. in getting their emissions down. I mean, Germany, where there's no climate denial, is building coal plants. The Koch brothers don't control the Bundestag, and they don't control the Chinese Central Committee. And yet, there's very little to point to in any of those places to suggest that they're on a better track in terms of actually reducing their emissions and seriously addressing climate change than is the U.S. The left, you know, has the science-based, we recognize the science, our solutions might not be right, but at least we're kind of acknowledging that there's a problem. And then you have the sort of right in the U.S. that is sort of science denying, either because they're crazy and ideological or because they are in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry or both. And I think that is a product in significant part of the way that the sort of climate issue gets framed and defined from very, very early on. And That framing has served the ideological interests and the sort of tribal self-defining interests of both the left and the right for a very long time. So we have to recognize that part of what's going on here is that the sort of tribal identity-based politics has taken over, all politics, certainly in the United States and a lot of other places as well. And the result is that, for all the talk about what an existential threat climate change is, people's political identities, their tribal identities, are actually much more important to them than whether we do something about climate change. And I would say that's as much the case for Bill McKibben as it is for Anthony Watts, the founder of the What's Up With That blog. Identity and ideology actually trump, no pun intended, doing anything about climate change. For McKibben, it's great to deal with climate change as long as we're doing the things that comport with his ideological preferences, which is downscaling consumption, capping emissions, and powering the whole world on renewable energy.
Aspirationally, though, we all wanted to go to renewables, but I remember 7 years ago speaking to Jesse Jenkins from your organization, and his portrayal of the price points was not a rosy one. It actually turned out to be a much better picture than initial thoughts. So if we don't aspire to higher goods, to true clean energy solutions, renewables, we're not going to get it. And you're saying we should maybe start with compromise and move back. And that's where I think that there's some value in the aspirational.
Yeah, I mean, I think aspiration is great, but I think, defining one's aspirations in ways in which there's opportunity for Americans across the political spectrum to find themselves, to see themselves in those aspirations, becomes really important.
Explain, what do you mean exactly?
Well, I think there are, a lot of people with good reason who are skeptical, even with significant cost declines. There's a lot of reasons to think that, if we get much past 30% of even electrical systems powered by renewable energy, by wind and solar, much less, the other 60, 70% of the global energy economy that is not powered by electric power, that would be a remarkable accomplishment. I would be happy for us to get to 30 or 40 or 50% wind and solar. That is not going to be anywhere close to sufficient to meaningfully mitigate climate change. So if you want an aspirational vision, and that's the case even if a lot of good analysis now suggesting that even if the panels and the wind turbines were free, that would be the case because of the extraordinary measures you have to take to deal with intermittency, not just on daily, but on monthly and seasonal levels.
Yeah, and by the time we're actually up to that 30, 40%, that's a good decade away. We're not even close to that.
Yeah, and I don't think that there is, I mean, look, most of the technologies that would be capable of doing that are not a decade away. They are many decades away before they even are can be significantly commercialized, at which point you might be able to start coming down a cost curve. So my point is, maybe I'll be wrong about that, but I'm not sure why we would put all our eggs in that basket, particularly when doing so actually makes the politics harder, not easier.
The piece is called Trump's Paris Agreement Withdrawal in Context. It's on foreignpolicy.com. Ted Nordhaus, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by The Meters, Little Feet, and Brian Stoltz. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.